You know, one of the themes, one of the main themes I have is to try to show you where in the social sciences there are some beautiful mathematical problems just waiting for mathematicians to come in and join them. The social scientists are developing some fascinating issues that we have to, that I think mathematicians should get in on the ground floor and work with the social scientists. On the first lecture, I showed you where there is some symmetry. Symmetry can be used to understand all sorts of weird things that go on. Second lecture, I showed you where this thing called singularity theory plays a key role in trying to answer certain types of questions which arise. And today, my emphasis is going to be on dynamical systems. But really, I'm going to be talking about evolutionary game theory. Now, to start with, what is game theory? Game theory, well, just think of it in terms of checkers or chess or any of these other type games. Really, game theory is what we as mathematicians have been doing all along with a nice twist. Each person is trying to optimize. We're trying to maximize. The trouble is, just like in checkers or chess, what I have to optimize depends on what you do, and what you have to optimize depends on what I do. And so what you're having is this optimization type effect really has this truly strategic type balance. And so what we have is, where does game theory crop up? I contend that game theory crops up everywhere where there are more than one where there's more than one person and you don't have identical goals or objectives. Let's just go through some of them. Here in a department, each individual faculty member, you have your goals. The chair has his goals. And what happens is they aren't always the same, and there's a little strategic going around. You know it, I know it. And as chair, I know it. And when I was a faculty member, or as faculty member, I know it. And it goes on. Let's take a look in terms of engineering, manufacturing. In engineering, you've got the designers. The designers are trying to design a product, and they're trying to have the optimal design. And you know what happens when they get done? They send it over to the manufacturing group, and the manufacturing group sends it back saying, we can't build that thing. And what the manufacturers want to build, the designers don't want to design because it's boring, and what the manufacturers, designers want to build, the manufacturers can't. And then we throw in marketing. Wow. And so what we have is you have different goals, different objectives. Each group is trying to optimize, do the best they can, but when it isn't the same, when you don't have the connections between them, what you end up with is, if we're going to try to understand how to do this, model it, try to find out what's going on and right, what we really need is game theory. It is, when you think about the social sciences, it's just absolutely full of situations where one group has one, another has another. Husband, wife. Take a look at in economics. People will have different objectives. And so really what we want to do is, each person wants to optimize, but what I optimize changes with what the other person does. Let me point out, this is a brand new area. Never mind this idea that's been around for 20, 30 years, or if you go back a couple hundred years. Forget that. This is a new area where the more mathematics you throw into the subject, the richer it becomes. And there are all sorts of ways of changing it. Let me give you a quick example of game theory, and then I'll get you to evolutionary game theory and show you where we get to do some dynamics and other things. Here's probably the best-known one. Prisoner's Dilemma. You see this every time you turn on TV on a Friday night and see a mystery show. Okay? What happens is, Neil and I, we're partners in crime. And what happens is we get caught. And Florin here is the cop. And you know what he's going to do. It turns out that an incredible number of crimes are solved only by somebody confessing. You don't have the information. You don't have the goods on you waiting for the confession. So if Neil and I, what happens is, if we cooperate, i.e. we still say, we didn't do anything. All right, they caught us doing something, so they're going to put us away for a year on that misdemeanor they caught us, if we both cooperate. But what they do is, You know what they do. You see it on all the TV shows. They'll put Neil in one room, they'll put me in another. They'll lean on us. They'll say, listen, if you squeal, we'll let you off. I'll get 0 years. But Neil will end up with 10 years. Or, if I cooperate with Neil, in other words, keeping my mouth shut, but Neil defects, what happens is I'll get 10 years penalty, he'll get off free. If we both defect, we'll both spend 5 years in jail. It's clear what we should do. We should both keep our mouth shut. It's clear what happens every Friday night. The show always ends the same way. One of us is going to squeal. And really what we do is go there and take a look. I have no control over what Neil does. I'm trying to optimize. I'm trying to find what's best for me. So I look at this and say, well, let me see. If Neil cooperates, my best thing is to defect. And if Neil defects, my best thing is to defect. So no matter what Neil does, my best thing is to defect. Okay, so you see what I'm trying to optimize is caught up with what the other person does. And what the other person does or tries to optimize is based on what I try to do. So the mathematics we're using here, it's very different. We have people from the social sciences here, and they will tell you that for the most part, a lot of the models we see are discrete models. But there's a lot of room in here for just throwing in any other kinds of mathematics you want, and it gets richer and more advantage. Now, where has game theory moved? Where has it gone? Well, all right. For years, we played games looking at... Oh, by the way, a Nash equilibrium is really, in some sense, a saddle point. And it is where you can't do better if you try to make the change on your own. And so the Nash equilibrium here is where you both defect and you both go away for 5 years. Why? If we're right here and I'm the only one who changes, the only thing I can change is to, I'm the first component. The only thing I can do to change is cooperate or defect. If I'm going away for 5 years, if I change, I'll go away for 10. I don't want that. And likewise with Neil. And so that's a Nash equilibrium. Okay? Now, one of the directions, and I think a very fruitful direction, that's been going on in the social sciences, is to say, how do we change the game? Okay, we have the outcome of a game, but how do you change it? Change it to get an outcome you want. Look. Who says that the game has to have the specific structure that we were talking about? We have the game right here. Here's a prisoner's dilemma. Any choice of the numbers will give you a prisoner's dilemma as long as B is B, that's what you get if you defect, is you just go through and write down the inequalities that you have to have. You want to have D, and you want to have C, and you want to have A. Any inequalities that you have right here will give you a prisoner's dilemma. Let me give you a concrete example, another concrete example of prisoner's dilemma. One of the things I've discovered since I've been up here in Victoria is that you really have two seasons. You have winter, and I understand that's only 36 hours a year here in Victoria, and you have construction season on the road. And so you're driving along, and what do? Is you get to a prisoner dilemma type situation. The sign says, merge to the left. If everyone merges to the left, you're going to smoothly go through. And somebody's going to defect from that cooperative sense, aren't they? You're going to stay on the right, and you're going to go to the last second, and you're going to create a bottleneck. Well, that is a prisoner dilemma. You just go through and map it, and that's precisely what the prisoner's dilemma is. Or... Yeah, I used to live in Evanston, Illinois, and Evanston, Illinois had a very progressive attitude about homeless. And so, and there was another suburb called Wilmette, a little bit to the north. What is it? To solve the homeless problem? If Wilmette and Evanston get together and put out the soup kitchens and training programs, etc., we will have a good movement if we both cooperate. But it is to the advantage of one of the communities called Wilmette to defect and do nothing. Why is it to their advantage? Because all the homeless will come to Evanston then and leave Wilmette. And if we both defect, then there is a serious problem about the homeless. So this question about the prisoner's dilemma and various other type things is around constantly. But suppose you have social policies. In social policies, you can change these by adding certain types of terms in here. And this is the direction in which the social scientists have been going, and they have created a whole wealth of things, a thing called incentives. Suppose what we're doing is we're trying to move in a certain direction. You know, the outcome is if we're left unfettered, we're going to go here. That's a bad outcome, a prisoner dilemma outcome. Suppose we create incentives for people to move in a certain direction. What's that? You change the game so the solution is somewhere else. A socially more acceptable one. And what you end up with then is an important area which is, quite frankly, a big, big topic in economics today, or something called a principal agent. I suppose I'm a CEO of a firm, and I'm trying to hire someone to do a certain job. I don't know if they're going to do that job right, so I can structure my contract right to make sure they're not free riding and doing their work. So really what we have are a large number of directions, but the direction I want to talk about is where we're throwing in dynamical change into the mix. Let me get you a concrete model, and then from there we're going to get into some of the mathematics, and I'm going to show you where a lot of the mathematics crops up. Concrete model. You're going to buy a Mac, you're going to buy a PC. What are you going to buy? Well, we know the Mac is better than the PC. PC is busily Microsoft, or some people to the south of us, or is it to the south east of us, are busily trying to capture all of what goes on the Mac on top of their operating system. But most people have PCs. Why is that? Well, buying a Mac or buying a PC is not just the hardware. If you've ever bought new hardware and you say, how in the hell does this work? Okay, which all of us have experienced, you know that it is more than just buying the equipment. It also involves who else has it and will they talk to me about it. As the economists like to say, it involves a thing called positive or negative externalities, in terms of whether you're going to get feedback and help. A lot of people buy a certain thing, there's going to be more software. A lot of people do certain things, and you're going to have different kinds of outcomes. So, what is it that we have? What I have here is X plus Y equals 1. I'm just finding the market share of both parties. And what some economists did, I'd say about a decade ago now, is they just stated that, well, at each instant of time, dx, dy, dy, dt, what they did is they gave a function of change. And the change was that the more people, it was in some sense the fitness, the more people that had a certain type of a computer, the more it was to your advantage. If you didn't have very many people of a certain type, the more it was to your disadvantage to have a certain type of a computer. So they wrote down the differential equations, and what they did is, instead of writing here, I'm going to write it right here, they discovered that indeed, that if you don't have very much, you're going to go to extinction. See, here's extinction or where one dominates. You're going to have extinction or something like this. And when they found the solution for the differential equation, they found there was an equilibrium point. Something of a threshold. And what does that tell me? That tells me that if I am on one side, if I'm over here, one company is going to dominate. If I'm over here, the other company is going to dominate. And it shows you just by this obvious fact that what I do, I need more other people doing it so I can get help from there. They wrote down the equations for this equation. Do you remember who it is? But you know which paper I'm talking about. Yeah. What they did is they showed that by a certain type of differential equation, they show that if you're in a certain type and there is success breeds on success, builds success, that there is a threshold point. And so what does this tell you? It tells you that some of the economic policies which Apple and Microsoft and some of the others doing, that we say, that's nice, look at the charity they're doing, is not really charity. They bring the apples and put them in all the schools and universities. What are they doing? It's not charity at all. If you get beyond a certain threshold, your company's going to take off and be the winner. Okay, so this right here, in my opinion, was a simple model. But really it captures the basic ideas of game theory, competition, who's going and what. But it also has dynamics built into it in terms of change. And what it does is it gives us interesting results in terms of what's going to happen. Very interesting results, what's going to happen, and prediction of policy, etc. All right. Let me give you a different model, and then we're going to start getting into see where there's a lot of meat in here for mathematicians. There is another game called the ultimatum game. This is well studied. There are more papers on this than I think any other game. It's very, very simple. The game's the following. I got $1,000. I'm given $1,000, and I can keep part of it under the following conditions. He knows the game rules. I know the game rules. And the game rules are the following. I'm going to offer him of that $1,000 a certain amount. If he accepts, he gets that amount and I get the rest. If he doesn't accept, I get nothing and he gets nothing. Think about that in terms of negotiations, etc., for contracts, etc. It's a very realistic, simple but realistic model. Okay? $1,000, how much should I offer him? $500. He says $500. Okay? Why don't I offer him a nickel? He gets nothing if I say no. The fact is that in the United States and in Canada and in Western Europe, you got to offer pretty close to 500, pretty close to a 50-50 mix. If you don't, they'll say no. Okay. You look at it from the viewpoint of game theory, you look at it from the viewpoint of economics, and that's stupid. Why not offer 400? If you can get away with 400, why not 300 or 200 or 100 or down to that nickel? But that doesn't come up. There's a certain resistance that's built in and say, you don't give me close to half, and that's it. You're not being fair, and the hell with it all. They've taken graduate students down at Berkeley and offering them amount in real money. I mean, this isn't hypothetical. This is real money in terms of a month's salary. And if they don't get close to 50%, forget it. Where does that come up? So really what we're doing is we're discovering in economics and elsewhere that we have things called social customs. But really it changes depending on the society. In some of the islands in the East, you play this game, and consistently the number is not 50-50. It is 30-70. I'll offer you 30% and you'll accept it. You'll accept it. 29, no. But 30%, you're very, very happy. So what we do is but there nevertheless is a threshold amount where people accept, depending on the culture. And so the big issue in economics, the big issue in philosophy of science, the big issue in large number is, where does this come from? Well, in a lot of cases, this cutoff comes from the following. It comes from social custom. We get used to it. I knew he was going to say 500, and I never thought, I knew he was going to say 500, half of it, because that's the usual social custom. We're going to say 50-50 split. Where do social customs arrive? And so that's one of the issues that crops up in evolutionary game theory, which does these things right here. And this has been a well-studied type thing. Why do we drive on the right-hand side of the road? And yet in a collision if you drive on the left. But why do we all agree to drive on the right? Social custom. I'll give you the history of that one, then I'll go on. See, people used to drive on the left in England and in France. Well, they didn't drive. They walked on there, and then the poor people had to go on the other side to avoid the carriages, etc. Then there was a little revolution in France. And a guy came around by the name of Napoleon. And Napoleon, and because of the revolution, they wanted to flaunt the idea of driving on the left, so they drove on the right, just to show they were against nobility. And then with the Napoleonic Wars, it spread. The idea of driving on the right spread throughout all of Europe. But it didn't, for obvious reasons, spread into England or into the English colonies. And so what we do is, that's where it came from. But where did it come from? So, and here is a topic that, and I'm talking here about Brian Skirm's work, where he really has a book called Social Customs, and is using dynamical systems. And in the ultimatum game, he says, starts off with the following example. Suppose somebody insists on two-thirds, absolutely insists on two-thirds of the money. That's it. I want two-thirds of the money. And if that person is against only people that want two-thirds of the money also, what's going to happen? They're going to die out. I want two-thirds, you want two-thirds, we're going to die out. Suppose the other part of the people want one-third. And so now what we're going to do is what Brian did is had a measure of fitness. If two-thirds people encounter two-thirds people at chance, what's going to happen to them? They're going to die off. If a two-thirds person runs into a one-third person, you're going to have a fitness. And so he has an equation which says, in terms of the fitness, in terms of the probabilities of interactions and things like this, what you do is you have a differential equation, and indeed you end up with a 50-50 mix. The dynamics goes here, the dynamics goes here. And what happens is with the dynamical systems, and the dynamical systems, you can write it down. I'll just tell you how to do it. You can write it down, the differential equation. You take the likelihood of, assume I'm going to have a random encounter. You find the percentage of people that are two-thirds and the percentage of people that are one-third. Okay? So what you do is from that you can find the likelihood I'm going to encounter a two-thirds person and a one-third person. If I encounter a two-thirds person, I'm going to die off. If I encounter a one-third person, I'm going to reproduce. A one-third person encounters a one-third person, they're going to reproduce. If they encounter a two-thirds person, they're going to reproduce. But they won't reproduce as fast as a two-thirds. They're not eating as much of the cake. And so you write down the equation and then just normalize so that you're on a unit interval. And what you do is you get a differential equation and you end up with a 50-50 mix. All right. So let me show you one more type example on here. Suppose a two-thirds person and a one-third person comes along. But suppose we now have somebody who wants only a half. See, what we get from Brian's work is that if you have two-thirds people and one-third type people, your social customs and society is going to evolve so where you get a 50-50 mix, according to his equations. What happens if we get a one-half person in there? So he wants two-thirds, I want one-third, and he wants a half. we're talking about many, many, many people of our type clones. So we're talking about the probability of encountering one of these three clones. And what's going to happen? You write down the differential equation for this type of a thing and find out which type will be reproducing and which type will die out. And you end up with the following differential equation, this solution. If there are no one-half people, you have the story that I told you. If you have only two-thirds and one-half people, the two-thirds people are going to die out because no matter who they encounter, they're going to starve. Right? If I want two-thirds and I run into someone who wants two-thirds, we're going to come to loggerheads and nothing's going to happen. If I want two-thirds and you want a half encounter, we're both going to starve. The one-half person will encounter a half, they're going to do fine. So they're going to die out, and here the one-half people eat more, they get fatter and healthier, and they die in. And what Brian found through computer simulations is you've got a little point here. And the dynamics looks like this. The dynamics looks like this. It's fascinating. Let me show you what happens. It shows, suppose we all of a sudden get a mutant, a small number of one-half people. If you get a small number of one-half people, what does it say is going to happen? Boom. The one-halves are going to die out. They're going to die out. But suppose we get a sufficient number across a threshold of one-half people. Then the solution is going to go here, and it's going to go here. And they're going to kill off all the two-thirds and the one-thirds. And only the half-half people will come up. So I know they're going to give an answer of 50%. Is this the explanation that's going on? Is this really what happens? I don't know. Look, I work in the Newtonian n-body problem. And I don't know if the equations of motion that Newton gave us are accurate. But I do know they give answers and good predictions. Is this exactly how people behave? Well, it sure gives you a nice predictive type device. So this is the kind of results. Any questions at this stage? Any question? Anyone have a question about anything?
Well,
yeah?
Are these two-third, one-third societies you mentioned stable or unstable?
No, really what happens is you end up with a 50-50% division here with Brian's type stuff.
But there are currently cultures that have one-third.
Yeah, and I'm going to get to that next. And he's raising the type of question that I have. He says, okay, Don, he says, Ryan's work shows you get a 50-50, but you just got through talking about cultures where they have the 70-30, and it is stable. It is stable, if they say it's stable. And it is stable. Yeah?
But the equilibrium point that you do have in there would depend on the reproduction rates of the various people.
Gosh. What he's doing is he's saying that, well, how much of the solution, how much of the solution is dependent upon the model? He's stating, look, you got a model there. How much of that solution depends on the equations I write down? Okay. Because if I talk about different reproduction rates or different cultural forces, maybe the equilibrium point will be to the right, and I'll get a 70-30 point. Excellent. And then looking at it, and we've had discussions about this, in terms of structural stability. You know, you got these models and you perturb them ever so slightly, will you get the same thing back again? You know, if I have an equation telling me, I have an equation, here's equilibrium. Oops, I perturb it ever so slightly and it's not equilibrium anymore. Suppose I have an equation and I change the equation ever so slightly. Will I get the same solution? The same behavior? And so really what we do from a mathematician's viewpoint is we're worrying about robustness. Robustness of the model. Because remember, in the social sciences, when we're looking at the equations from the social sciences, we're writing down an equation. It is not guaranteed by experiment like we have in a lot of physical sciences. So therefore, we really need, in any model we write down in the social sciences, we really need to redress the question of robustness. If I change the model ever so slightly, will the solutions, will the predictions still pertain? And third, quite frankly, this model that I wrote down about the PCs, while it's very nice, it does not predict what happened. It does not predict what happened. It gives us a sense of what happened. It says that if one company has a market share, gets over a certain threshold, it's going to dominate. And PCs are dominating. Macintosh is still around. So it doesn't predict what's going on. So the question then is there a way of looking at information about the parts, and how does it dictate the whole? And a third direction, fourth direction, fifth direction, really is in terms of networks. You know, let's look back at that question I said about the one-third, two-third people. The one-third, two-third people, and I'm going to randomly go out and I'm going to encounter a one-third, two-third people. Not very likely. Are you going to randomly go out and run into someone from New York City today? Or something like that? Of course not. There are certain networks and certain things like this. So once you start talking about networks, we're starting to talk about dynamical systems on graphs. Where are you? There. Dynamical systems on graphs, which is going to give you a much, much richer type situation. So I'm going to start to address some of these issues right here. And I'm going to show you how to, looking at these things from a dynamical systems perspective, how the mathematics helps us get around all of these difficulties. Let's go back to following question. Suppose I know that all I know is that if a company is dominating, if a company dominates, its dominant share is going to wipe out its competition. Suppose either this company is going to dominate, it's going to wipe it out, or either this company is going to dominate, and it's going to wipe it out. That and a belief in continuity is all I know. Can we construct all possible models? Capturing this. And the answer is yes. Up to a certain restrictions, yes. Let's see how. I'm going to have this to be my velocity direction, and I'm going to have this being my position direction. So what is this? My velocity is going to the left. That's negative, so I know I'm starting off at some point here. And I know my velocity is positive up here, so it's going to be over here. And I now want to find the class of models where the line starts from here and goes to here. First quarter of calculus. We know that no matter how I draw that line, it's got to cross somewhere. Or it may cross several times. So from here, you immediately can write down the dynamics. Let's take this interesting one right here. I've got an equilibrium. It's positive, so it's going to the right. Negative, it's going to the left. Here's the other equilibrium. It's going to this point right here. Now it's going in. Now it's going out. Now it's going in. Now it's going out. And so I see that just by looking at local information, it's that if I have any difficulties of this type right here, that if I just know local information about what happens if you dominate, that if one corporation dominates, index theorems, here, just simple calculus, tells us that whatever model I write down, it doesn't matter what the particulars are. Whatever model I write down, it's got to cross, generically, an odd number of times. And generically, it says that what's going to happen is I'm going to have little pockets of stability. And I'm going to have a lot of different threshold points to overcome. So just from looking at, you know, this model of about 10 years ago, where they wrote down a specific equation which was debatable. In fact, people debated their particular equation. What we have is, that doesn't matter. Looking at very, very simple information, just by going from the left and knowing what happens at the right and looking at continuity, we can make similar type policy decisions that we know it's going to crop up. These things right here are going to occur. Likewise here. If instead of going to the right, we know it goes to the left. Like in the ultimatum game. You know you have to have a crossing. Where that crossing is, I don't know. But you know you have to have a crossing. And you know there's going to be, in any society where you have this ultimatum and you know one group is going to survive over another, just like you're saying, I don't know what the equations are, but you know there's going to be, that the qualitative behavior is going to be that. So we have a robustness type result now, which captures these things. Okay? You can have multiple crossings. It's just the number of times. Just draw any curve. Just don't have any tangencies, because that's not going to be robust. A slight little change. Let's take a look at the robustness type results. This right here is will occur if I have a zero here. If I have a zero eigenvalue here. And what happens is if I have a zero here, well, I could break that by going up or going down, and I can find all possible ways to break that situation if it's a zero on the end. All possible ways to draw the curve. And what you can then get is all possible dynamics which are going to come in and cause all sorts of behavior. It gets more interesting, mathematically interesting, once we get into higher dimensions. Yes, please.
It's robust if you assume continuity.
If you assume, and I carefully said continuity, I assume continuity.
But is that reasonable? Is another question. You could have
bang-bang
behavior.
Sure. You could have bang-bang type behavior. But if you have bang-bang type behavior, you've got some radical changes in between. And you would know that. You would then be able to identify where there's a bang-bang type point. That's a singularity. And singularity, equivalent to a singularity, and you would have very difficult things. So if we're talking in terms of continuity, in other words, I'm talking in terms of continuity, but his point is a very important one. Once you start realizing that there are other ways of going here, you start getting a qualitative results and getting richer, richer theory that goes on. But you have to justify when that can occur. Here is what I want to do. Is okay, we did the simple ones. Now let's go to this one right here. What do we have? Remember Brian's other model in terms of the two-thirds, one-third, and it doesn't, never mind the ultimatum game, that's just a model game. Suppose you have that local behavior right there. It's all I know is I have that local behavior. It's all I know. And I want to get, all I know is that this vertex right here, the dynamics of survival, the dynamics from biology, a lot of this evolutionary stuff started in biology, the dynamics of a species surviving or anything else is such that it's going to go outwards. And here it's going to go outwards. And here it's going to go inwards. It's going to be a sink. Okay. And the question I want to ask is, complete that story. Give me all possible stories with that local information. Well, we have one point here. We know that if these two are going towards each other, just by the story I told you, there's going to be an equilibrium here. Now I have to understand where, by stories, does it come inwards or does it go outwards? So let's say it goes inwards. Next question is do we have anything else? And here we have a term that comes from complex variables, algebraic topology, which is the winding number. Fascinating result. Let me write on a board one example of the winding number and then apply it. Winding number is really, in some sense, a souped-up fixed-point theorem. It's a souped-up fixed-point theorem. Well, under what conditions do I know there's going to be a fixed point? Coffee, you stir it, and you know that at each instant of time, one molecule is right where it was before if you're smoothly, under smoothness, not rapid, but smoothness, smoothly stirring your coffee. So if I have a vector field which is coming inwards on the inside, what does the winding number tell you? It says, how does this wind all the way around? What this is just a souped-up version of what I was saying about drawing a curve. How many times does a curve cross the x-axis? And what you do here is you say, okay, let's start with a vector here and see how that vector, that's my elbow, is going to be here. And we see how it's going around. And it's pointing here. And I'm going to break my arm off because it's going to go all the way around and won't make one complete circle. So the winding number here is 1. And the fascinating statement is that generically, the number of points inside here, the equilibrium points that I have inside here, have to satisfy the following relationship. If we say that if everything is going out in a certain direction, we will give that a number plus. If it is coming in a certain direction, we'll give that minus. In other words, stable, unstable manifolds. Which is give it plus or minus depending on whether, minus if it's being attracted, being sucked in, plus if it's being pushed out. And each point has precisely two directions on this two-dimensional type thing. And what it says is, for each one of these equilibrium points, multiply the signs. So this one right here gives me a minus 1. This one right here gives me a plus 1. This one right here. So this one right here is minus times a minus, plus 1. This one's a plus times a plus. That's a plus 1. Says you go through each and every one of those points and you find the sign. And you add up all these signs. And you better pick that number back again. It's the winding number. So what does it say? It says right here that if I had only these two equilibriums, I showed you that the winding number here is 1. And what do I have? I have 1 plus 1 plus a minus 1. That's consistent. 1 is equal to a minus 1 plus 1 plus 1. If I found another equilibrium over here with a plus 1, I know then there has to be still another equilibrium hiding in there with a minus 1 hanging around. What is this? This is by use of topological arguments, etc. It is nothing more than a souped-up version of this right here. See? Crosses. If it crosses again, it's got to cross again, a plus and a minus. Just count the slopes, if you will. The slopes have to add up in the right way so that the overall slope is the same. Much like the generalized mean value theorem or something else like this. So this is just a generalized version, to higher dimensions of this fact right here. And it becomes then a powerful tool. The reason it becomes a powerful tool is that if we take a look at the drawing which I have here, which is just a local information from Bynes-Kerms. I don't know anything about the dynamics, how the dynamics runs. I don't know anything about really what happens in between. I don't know any of the other economics. I'm only comfortable with the economics near an equilibrium type point. That's all I know. Then if I take a look and see how this is going, well, I have to extend this, extend this, extend this, extend this, extend this, extend this. All I know is that local information, and I want to compute the winding number. So let's compute the winding number. Right here, sliding over, sliding over, sliding over, so I'm one. I've wound around once. Coming down, wound around once. Now, whoops, I'm unwinding, and if I did this right, I should end up with one solution all the way around. So really what I'm doing is to get this is I'm counting the winding number not on the boundary, but on a fictitious boundary around the outside. And if I did this correctly, if I went through the winding, you just go through and compute it, just like I did, just start right here, and you see it's going down. Okay, I'm at a half. I said one. Oh, no, I'm at one. And then I go around. Now I'm at two. And then here's where I get some unwinding. And if you do it right, you should end up with one. And so what does that tell me? It says this number right here is one. This number right here is one. See, out, 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 out. That's one. And here's a minus one. So I get one, minus one, plus one, plus one. And it says no matter what the story is from the dynamics, I need another point in the interior. And that point I need in the interior has to have index minus one. And if it has minus one, then you use some other ideas from dynamical systems. This has to end up somewhere, and so you know it comes from here. You know it comes from here. You know it has to go here.
At least one.
There has to be at least one. So this is the simplest model that you can have. And what you do then, just by use of the idea of let's find the simplest model, you see that without having to work and then argue and then fight by use of the power of the mathematics, what you do is you see that any situation of this type right here will lead you to a phenomena where there is a basin where the mutant gets wiped out and another basin where the mutant becomes dominant and wipes out the other species. Whether the species happens to be from biology or whether the species happens to come the economic species of special types and getting to social customs. Let me give one more example. I think I have time for one more example. And the other example is that everything's coming in. Oh, Florence says at least one example like this, and that's correct. Because you see, I really have to add a minus one. See, when I went through, the winding number is one, and I was off by a certain amount. So I knew I had to add a minus one in here. But to get a minus one, I can add a plus one and a minus one. I can add a plus one and a minus one and get a richer model. And what you do then is you know that the richer model, you know exactly, you just have to then go through and figure out what the richer model is going to be. You just put in the other points and ask, well, you know one of them has to have something coming in and going out. Something coming in and going out, and something either going in or going out. Everything going in or going out. And then you can just play games by connecting lines to find out what that model has to be. And it's only slightly more complicated than this. But the important fact is that we're now getting all possible. We don't have to worry about the dynamics now just by use of basic ideas from topology. We don't have to worry about those things, so we get a much, much richer evolutionary game theory type model. And to conclude, I'll just say what happens here, that if you do this, you have an equilibrium. I'm going to assume the equilibrium is just like this. It could be the other way. If it's the other way, you get a different winding number. Different winding numbers, you have different stories. And what happens here is it becomes beautiful. One of the situations that you can get is this. It turns out you could get a that you have to have three equilibrium here. You need two positives and you need one negative when you compute the winding number all the way around. And the motion's fun. What it does is you've got two other equilibriums right here, and the motion comes like this. It comes from here and it cycles around and around and around and around and around and comes up and goes up like this. And from here, you get the other cycling. It goes around and around and around and around and it goes up like that. So this is something you could never pick up by numerical experimentation. But by just asking a simple question without even knowing the dynamics and just counting the index of these type things, what we're able to do now is to handle all of these type issues. So really, what's the punchline? The punchline, and this extends, by the way, to any dimensions. To any dimension. So I can talk about three dimensions, 1,000 dimensions, any dimension you want. The winding numbers are harder to compute. Much harder to compute. And we're starting to get pretty much into the cutting edge of a lot of these computational type problems because I got a hold of all my friends in algebraic topology, Mark Mahold at Northwestern, various others, and they're all saying, oh, damn, Don. Why don't you try this because we can't handle that. Okay. So you're really getting into some of the cutting edge. But the point is that by these simple models which we have from here and asking the questions that a mathematician will ask, but why that particular equation? By asking, can we generalize it in various ways? Well, we're just looking at vector fields and we're looking at the boundary and what can happen in the interior. By realizing that we have networks and we have then directed graphs and dynamics on graphs rather than over spaces like this. What you do is you end up with a large number of questions which you don't normally run into in dynamical systems. And the consequences on here definitely enrich, significantly enrich, because it now says, never mind those particular equations, significantly enrich the social sciences. So again, I end with my usual thing. Mathematicians, be interested in social sciences. It's rich. Social scientists, be interested in the mathematics. It's powerful. For that, I thank you.
Equilibrium in the interior.
No. In fact, that's a fascinating thing. Is you can't because you see, this analysis only says that it's a minus one. I mean, plus one. And as you point out, so I may have the following, is I may have everything. Suppose everything is pointing inwards. If everything is pointing inwards, that we have something like this, the winding number is one. The winding number is 1. Just take it and go all the way around. So that's the simplest case, and you get a winding number of 1. So if you get a winding number of 1, then what I know is I know that the simplest case is I have a point here with index 1. But how do I get index 1? Well, I can get index 1 by being a stable attractor, so everything gets sucked into here. Or I can get an index of minus 1. I mean, 1, but everything is going out. Then the issue is, how in the world do you tie all these things together? Well, the only way you can tie these together is if there is a limit cycle here. And so all of these things are going into this limit cycle, and this is coming around like this. Let me give you where this example crops up in economics. Economists have a certain type thing, which they use for fixed point theorems, of trying to say that the supply and demand story work. Well, let's look at this. What happens is these will be the different prices, and I'll go into this more specifically next lecture on Monday. Here are the different commodity prices, and then what happens is we know how much do you want the demand. What's your demand going to be? Well, if something's free, you're going to want a lot of that object, aren't you, if it's a desirable thing. If you find out that Subarus are free, you're going to order a couple of them. at least. And so what they know is that if something is free, people are going to want a lot of it. Does that mean there's going to be a stable equilibrium? Well, it's the index theorem. You go around there and you say, there's got to be an equilibrium inside there. But is it stable? And the answer is no, not necessarily. It could be a repeller. And you can create examples where it's a repeller, where as soon as you're very, very close to an equilibrium, you scat away from it and never come back. So it becomes a powerful tool for looking at these type issues. So you're absolutely correct. Yeah. Any other questions anyone has? No other questions?
Well, thank you very much. Once again, Don, thank you very much.
Those procedures are throwing in a box.